أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Brothers and sisters, respected ulama, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here amongst you. I thank all the organizers for inviting me. I always love coming to these Muslim Congress programs because I get the chance to meet with people I haven't seen in a long time. I get the chance to meet with the ulama because we don't get to see each other very often, especially I'm all the way in Sydney, and also the brothers and sisters in the cities that I've gone to speak. It's really a good thing. Inshallah, I'll have the time to catch up with everyone here while I'm here, and you know, this is a blessing. Now, I was asked to speak about politics and Islamic government, and I was struggling a little bit to figure out exactly what I wanted to talk about, because I always like to mention something that's directly relevant to us as well, right? So not just a theoretical speech about Islamic government, but try to find something that we could benefit from and take home too. Thank you, brother. So what I decided to do is I was looking at a book that's actually been translated into English. So in 1970, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures about Islamic government. And he was in Najaf at the time, in exile from Iran. And these lectures have been translated into English, so anyone who wants to refer back to them is able to. They were translated by Dr. Hamid Algar of Berkeley, and it's called, the book is called Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, right? So what I want to do in this speech is I want to look a little bit at the first lecture where Imam Khomeini is discussing the necessity of an Islamic government. And we're gonna highlight one point about the purpose of the Islamic government, what the Islamic government aims to achieve. Then inshallah, later in the speech, after we go over this brief summary, then what we're gonna do is we're gonna go back to that purpose and see if we in the West could implement part of it in a way where, although we're not living under an Islamic government here, of course, maybe we can still benefit from some of the ideals, or at least get a little bit close without the overall environment of the society. All right, so if that's okay with you, please recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So in Imam Khomeini's first lecture about Islamic government, he starts by saying that there are three things necessary to ensure reform and happiness, right? And these three things are Islamic laws, the Islamic form of government, and the executor of the Islamic government, which are all provided to us by Allah. So Allah reveals the Islamic laws, Allah reveals, and also from the lifetime of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam, we see the form of government, and Allah blesses us with the executor in the personality of the Prophet, the Imams, and in the, what's it called, the major occultation, the representatives of the Imams. Now, that first part of this sentence though, the Islamic government wants to ensure reform, so reform meaning those who aren't on the right path or who are straying a little bit, will have an atmosphere conducive to them being able to enter into the fold of Islam, enter into spirituality and get closer to Allah. And second thing was happiness. Happiness, why? Because if you don't have a good sense of well-being, then you won't be able to concentrate on spirituality. You'll be worried about the world, you'll be worried about the hardships that you're facing in the world, and you won't be able to concentrate on your relationship with Allah. So that's why well-being and happiness is important. Now, I want to go over, summarize briefly the reasons and the necessity of this government, and then I'm going to return back to this point on happiness, inshallah. So Imam Khomeini says that there's a number of arguments or proofs of why this government is necessary. One of them is that it was part of the Sunnah. So we know that, of course, the ahadith of the Prophet are authoritative, are hujjah upon us. Whatever the Prophet says, we must follow. But it's not only his sayings, his actions as well. So the Prophet established an Islamic government in Medina. So in order to follow the Sunnah, we should establish an Islamic government. Furthermore, it wasn't only in his time. So after him, he designated Imam Ali al-Islam to continue this path and be the caretaker and the administrator of the Islamic government. Man kuntu mawla fahada aliyin mawla. Right? Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Another interesting point is that even in that society at that time, after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam passed away, the debate in the Islamic Ummah was never about whether there should be an Islamic government, right? So all of those who were fighting for power at that time, none of them said, well, maybe we shouldn't have an Islamic government. We should let either the Romans or the Persians rule over us, and we'll just sit and wait. Right? This was never an option. The debate was, who's going to be in charge of the Islamic government? Right? And of course, the Prophet designated someone through the guidance and the command of Allah, but the people, unfortunately, didn't follow. So, but the debate was about the leader, who's the leader, and somehow about the scope of authority of this leader, right? Whether he has the same position as the Prophet or not, right? The debate was never about whether there should be an Islamic government. Everyone accepted that. So we could use this as a consensus. We could use this as a form of ijma, where we say that this is also a proof. Now, interestingly enough as well, when we talk about Wilayatul Faqih, which I'm sure some other speakers will discuss in more detail, this is actually the same debate about Wilayatul Faqih as the debate there, where no one's debating whether the jurist has authority. Everyone accepts that a faqih has a certain amount of wilayat. The debate is how much, the scope. Does he have absolute wilayat? Can he perform offensive jihads? Or is it limited in some sense, right? Also, who should be the wali faqih is a debate among some people, right? But it's not about whether the faqih has authority. So it's interesting, you can see the similarities with that debate. Now, Imam Khomeini then tried to appeal to an emotional side, and through that we could also use, you know, reasoning to understand his point here. He said that the Prophet labored very hard. It was very difficult for him to create social change in the environment that he was raised in. The environment that he was raised in was a terrible, terrible environment, right? Arguably much worse than what we live in today. There's stories where certain conquerors came to the Arab Peninsula to conquer this area. And when they saw how the people in that area were living, they didn't want anything to do with them and just left. They said, let them be. I don't even want this area. Right? That's how bad these people were living. Murder and war was rampant. There were wars that were lasting over a century long. Right? So the Aus and Khazraj tribes, they actually went to the Prophet to mediate this war that was over a century long. You have idol worship, you had promiscuity, you had racism and tribalism, very deep-rooted tribalism. You had gender inequality in that society, right? So women, if they weren't buried alive at childhood, they were considered property. Right, so like imagine, I mean, a lot of us are fathers and mothers. Imagine when Allah grants you a daughter. You've heard this many of times, but think about it. Sometimes we just talk about it and we brush over it, but actually think about it. When you see your baby daughter for the first time, right? Imagine your reaction was not love and thanks. Your reaction was anger and embarrassment. Your face would turn black, red, right? Whatever color embarrassment is seen. You would go and you would bury your daughter alive. in order to face the society. I think about that. Think about how off and how terrible society must be that that's the norm. Then after that, those fathers who didn't bury their daughters, the women, the few girls who survived that, right? They weren't considered human. There's accounts where people are giving an inventory of their property. They say, I have 4 camels, 3 sheep, 2 women. They're listed amongst the property. And the prophet is sent to this society to create social change in this society. And he labored hard. Imagine the difficulty of trying to change such a society in only 23 years. And he was successful, and he was able to institute many changes. But are we saying after he passes away, that's it? Then we revert back to the way we were? Or at least maybe until the minor occultation. The imams, during their time, they should administer the Islamic government, but after them, that's it? Right? In order to maintain these social changes, there has to be, you know, there has to be an administrator over the social construction of the society. Without that, all of these changes would go away. All of the effort that the Prophet exerted would disappear. The society would revert back to what it was before, right? And we see that afterwards, unfortunately, after the Prophet passed away, the Ummah became divided, which was most likely started before he passed away, but the Ummah became divided. They started going after power and creating monarchies and stepping away from the ideals of Islam. And then we see the ramifications and the results from that. So the farther you gravitate away from this Islamic laws and the Islamic form of government that was introduced by the Prophet, the less of an atmosphere you have that's conducive to those, for those two things, for reform and happiness, right? Now, as I said, I want to concentrate a little bit on happiness here. Because with happiness, we can reach spiritual success. Without it, it'll be difficult. Now, that being said, if happiness is so important, if it's one of the purposes of this Islamic government, then in the Quran and in our traditions, we have to have some mention of happiness, of how to become happiness, of how to maintain this happiness, right? If not, then there would be something missing from our religion, right? So, alhamdulillah, we do have a lot, actually. So if you don't have that which you need, you won't be happy. You need to have the necessities of life. And in Al-Kafi, one of the most important books of Islamic traditions, there's a whole chapter called All the Needs of Man Are Set Out in the Quran and Sunnah. A whole chapter of traditions. Right, so we have a lot. Now, ayah of Quran I wanted to mention. But before that, I want us to think for 1 second. Right? What is it that we think causes happiness? Now, I'm in a room of religious people, so hopefully it wouldn't be too hard to come to the correct answer. But if you look in the general society, in the overall society, people will have different answers. Right? A large portion of people would say money. Right? If I had a lot of money, I'd be happy. Right? I just got off the plane from Sydney to here yesterday. It was a long trip. It was difficult. It was, you know, tiring. And if I had enough money that I could buy a private jet, I'm sure it'd be a lot more comfortable. Right? I'd come here. I'd have all the energy in the world right now, and I'd give a much better speech, and I'd be happy. Right? Or if I was able to have a summer home in Paris or whatever. You know, I was able to have enough money to get whatever I wanted in my mind. Now, of course, us being religious, we want different things than general society, but still, if we had everything, we'd be happy. Now, is this something that is acceptable in Islam or not? Obviously, we'll say no. But to a certain extent, it might be. So if you're living in extreme poverty, you won't be happy. If you're not meeting the basic needs of life, you're not going to be happy. There's a tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Al-miskana miftahul bus. So poverty leads to misery, right? And we have other traditions that say it eats away at faith, right? So extreme levels of poverty do lead to misery. But does extreme levels of wealth lead to happiness? That's the question. There was a little experiment that was done. So I'm going to mention a few studies in my speech now, because I was doing a lot of research looking in academic journals about psychology and religion. I found a few interesting ones I wanted to mention. Now, of course, the words of these academics are not hujja upon us, right? We have Quran and Hadith and ulama, and these are much more important. But these studies could support what we're saying. Now, one of the studies was about happiness and wealth. And they found, they studied a group of people in the United States. They found that they used $50,000 income as the baseline. And they compared people who earned less than $50,000 against people who earned more than $50,000. And they said that there was a significant difference in happiness, meaning those who earned more than $50,000 were more happy. But when they, what's it called, when they examined people who earned between $50,000 up to $5 million, there was no difference in happiness. So between $50,000 and $5 million, if you're making $5 million a year, you have whatever you want, unless your wants are crazy, but you should have everything you want. Now, what that means is if you're not able to make these basic needs, then you're gonna be struggling. So the Islamic government needs to have a strong enough economy and have a strong enough, you know, social support system that the basic needs of the people are taken care of. But over that, it doesn't matter how much you make after that for happiness. And happiness is important to be able to worship Allah correctly. Now, if it's not money, what is it? If money is not the answer, what will bring us happiness? There's a verse of Quran that might help us understand. It says, "Alladhina amanu wa amanu salihat, toba lahum wa husnu ma'ab." So those who have faith and do righteous deeds, happy are they, and good or blessed is their destination. So the keys to happiness are faith and good deeds. So in other words, taqwa or piety. Right, and not that outer shell, right? Not only concentrating on the outer aspects of Islam and performing it ritualistic or habitualistic. Actually trying to go into the depths, because faith is also a part. So concentrating both on the outside and the inside. And this combination will lead to happiness. Right, so the spiritual joys in Islam are better and more important and more lasting and more effective than material or physical pleasures. Right, Shahid Mutahiri, he says that happiness is achieved through controlling one's rational desires, not succumbing to them. Right, or sorry, not rational, carnal desires, not succumbing to them. Right, so sin is pleasurable. If sin wasn't pleasurable, no one would sin, right? Drugs and alcohol intoxicate you. Intoxication is pleasurable. If it wasn't, people wouldn't destroy their lives chasing a high, right? People wouldn't throw their lives away if becoming intoxicated wasn't pleasurable, right? Any sin you could think of, I'm not going to get too graphic here, but any sin you could think of is pleasurable. If it wasn't, people wouldn't destroy themselves seeking it. So therefore, you have a choice. Am I going to choose this short pleasure, this short-lived pleasure? And is this going to give me happiness? Or controlling these desires and living my life for something bigger? Right, Islam says the latter option will bring you true happiness, right? There's a couple of studies which support this. I'm gonna just mention one of them, and then I'll close from there. So one study, I wrote an article about this on 14 publications. You can check it out if you want more information. But there's a very interesting study conducted by a Western academic in the United States. And he wanted to see if wearing hijab led to, a better level of well-being or happiness or not. And he didn't know which way it's gonna go. He didn't know if wearing hijab will make you less happy or more happy, right? So what he did is he created three groups of Muslim women and he tested them. So one group was a group of sisters who don't wear hijab. Second group was a group of sisters who wear hijab with tight clothing. And third group is sisters who what he called wear proper hijab, which meant hijab with loose-fitted clothing, right? And he compared these three groups in levels of self-esteem, depression, and anxiety. And he wanted to see which groups would have better levels of in these areas. So he hypothesized that maybe the women who wear hijab in society will be ostracized. They'll be considered outcasts in the society. When they walk in the streets, people will look at them funny. People might say things to them, might ridicule them in the streets. Right? I was talking at breakfast, they might get kicked out of the airplane just for wearing hijab. Right? They could face difficulties in the society only because they wear hijab. And then this could raise their depression levels and anxiety levels. So he says maybe the hijab will have a negative effect. Then he says, but on the other hand, if someone wears the hijab, they'll have an increased sense of identity. The community might accept them more and give them more social support. Now, of course, he wasn't Muslim, so he didn't look at the religious factor behind it as well, right? So we consider wearing a good hijab is part of piety, right? It's an instance of obedience to Allah. Now, of course, it has to have the correct intentions behind it, right? So it's not only wearing the clothes, but it's wearing the clothes with the correct intentions leads to piety, leads at least in that dimension. So hopefully we'll see the results, meaning that they have better, levels of anxiety and depression, or lower levels. So when he did this study, he found exactly that. He found that the sisters who wore proper hijab had lower levels of depression and anxiety than the other two groups. But the group that didn't wear hijab and the group that wore hijab with tight clothing, they didn't have any difference between the two. So it was only obedience was the factor. Now, when I mentioned this, I wrote this article, I got some people attacked me on this article and they thought this was really bad. I welcome all attacks on any of my articles, so don't be shy. But what's it called? A sister said that she knows plenty of women who wear hijab but have high levels of depression, who wear hijab and have suicidal ideation, right? That are in danger of committing suicide even. So how could you say that wearing hijab has these effects? Now, first of all, I didn't do the study, so I'll do a study hopefully in the future. But second of all, we have to concentrate on the intention, right? So just wearing hijab out of habit, wearing hijab culturally, wearing hijab because your mother does, that's not gonna have the desired effect, right? Yes, it's good, it's an act of obedience. But if you want to ascertain those levels of well-being and happiness that are conducive to reaching higher stages of spirituality, it has to be a deeper reason why you're wearing hijab, right? Or performing any act of worship, right? It can't just be the outer shell. It has to be the inner dimension has to be there as well. And I think Maulana Abbas will talk about that in his breakout session more, inshallah. So everyone go to that session. Now, I want to bring it back. So we're talking about Islamic government and I'm talking about happiness and how does that relate? So the purpose of Islamic government is to create this environment conducive to reform and happiness so we could reach higher levels of spirituality. Happiness is ascertained through taqwa, right? According to the verse of Quran and some of the studies supporting it. So practically, what can we do? Right? If we increase our levels of taqwa, inshallah, that should help us attain higher levels of well-being and happiness. And through that, we can inshallah get closer to Allah. Now, of course, the environment here isn't we're not living in an Islamic government, so the atmosphere around us isn't necessarily conducive to taqwa. Right? When you walk out in the street, it's not the easiest thing to be pious always. Right? There's a lot of peer pressure, social pressures. Sin is, you know, in front of your face all the time. If you go to school, university, the workplace, it's difficult. But the more you strive and struggle, right, the better you could become. So inshallah, the takeaway point is to work on our piety. And inshallah, some of the future speakers will define that and tell us how, inshallah. So with that, I'm going to close, and I want to say what I said at the beginning as well, that I'm really happy to be here, and I want to thank everyone for inviting me, and I look forward to sitting down and talking to all of you, inshallah, if we have time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.